This is Pop Culture Confidential, and I'm Christina Yerling-Biru. Welcome to Pop Culture Confidential, a part of the Evergreen Podcast Network. The biggest television show in the world. That's what we're going to be talking about. Squid Game, the South Korean dystopian drama by writer-director-producer Hwang Dong-hyuk, is currently on track to becoming Netflix's most popular show ever, reaching number one in 90 countries. The show is about a mysterious survival game played by many hundreds of competitors. They play children's games facing violent death, competing for a prize of 46 billion won. It's spectacular, exciting, edge of your seat, and brutally violent. It's infused with themes of class divide, exploitation of the poor, and financial desperation, themes that resonate all over the world. I'm very happy to have with me Korean professor Dr. Aryam Jong. She researches and teaches Korean film, theater, and performance, including South Korea's modern culture and K-pop. She's taught at UCLA and UC Santa Barbara and is now at the Sichuan University Pittsburgh Institute in China. Dr. Jong joins me to talk about these themes resonating globally, the political and artistic impact of Squid Game, the director, the actors, and much more. Dr. Jong, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you for inviting me here.
So as someone who researches and follows Korean popular culture as closely as you do, how and when did you notice that Squid Game was exploding all over the world?
I think there were two moments. I mean, aside from the fact that my timeline on social media was just, you know, everybody having discussions and theories about, you know, the show after they binge watched it. I got a lot of requests, like you, to talk about Squid Game for media and press. And aside from, you know, boy bands like BTS, this was the first time I think so many people wanted me to talk about it. And also, you know, I teach in China. I'm currently based in Chengdu, China. I'm teaching at a university here. And it's a place where Netflix is actually illegal. And so a lot of Chinese people don't have access to Netflix or, you know, a lot of the social media platforms we use like Facebook or Instagram or YouTube. But I've noticed a lot of my colleagues, Chinese colleagues, and also students watching the show and discussing it, you know, asking me about my ideas. And so that's when I noticed, wow, you know, this is a place where you can't actually see Netflix, but everybody's already watched the show and they're talking about it. So that's when I noticed how big it was getting.
I want to ask you about how it's resonated in South Korea, but let me start internationally. What is the success of the show? Why does it resonate everywhere?
Yeah, I think that the show has a lot of factors, a lot of themes that not only South Koreans, but also a lot of international viewers can resonate and relate to. For example, the socioeconomic inequalities, the gap between the rich and poor, you know, this competition for all these resources, trying to move upwards, that upward mobility, and also, you know, the different power dynamics between race and different genders. And I think these are very universal themes that you see not only in South Korean film and television, but, you know, almost everywhere in the universe. So I think those kind of themes really resonated with not just, you know, Korean or just Asian viewers, but also a lot of, you know, international viewers who don't speak the language and maybe played very different childhood games, as you've seen from Squid Game. So I think those were some of the main common themes that the show did really well and viewers could resonate. because I mentioned the childhood games, I think it's also interesting how the show's setting, you know, the competition survival setting, it's not something new. We've all seen it before in the Hunger Games and the Japanese film Battle Royale. But I think the setting's simplicity and the predictability, I mean, we all knew who was going to win, right?
Yes.
And also like...
I didn't get the ending though. I didn't get who was behind it. That was I'm usually pretty good twist. At figuring that. Yes, that was a twist, but I did I did see the other things coming.
Yeah, I mean, we all knew it was going to like end up with that, you know, big sum of money. So I think, you know, the simpleness and the predictability of the setting just eases in the viewer, even if you don't know the language, even if you don't know the games. And then even if you don't know the games, the rules are very, very simple. And then in addition to that, you know, simpleness, predictability, the show just keeps you on the edge of your seat. You're wondering what's going to come up next, who's going to be eliminated in the next round, who's going to win that money. I mean, we all know. But so I think all of those little factors in the show, plus, you know, the striking design, the costumes, the very, you know, eerie, the music, really creates the atmosphere of the tense environment. I think all of those factors really just, you know, helped make the show into a global success.
Yeah. I want to ask you a bit more later about the sort of where its place is in Korean film, but in for a South Korean person today, is there anything else in particular that resonates?
I thought how Ali, you know, the single non-Korean character in the show, who is also this undocumented migrant worker from Pakistan, I thought the way he conducts himself and also how other people treat him in the show really reveals some of the true, these harsh realities that migrant workers face in Korea. I'm not sure if you know, but there is a lot of racism in Korea, especially toward migrant workers. And the way Ali's, you know, story is portrayed in Squid Game, you know, he hasn't been paid for several months, but there's nowhere to, you know, file a complaint. If he does, chances are he will get deported because he's undocumented. He's, you know, treated harshly by his boss. And even in the Squid Game, you see how he never addresses someone first by their name. He's always saying 사장님, which is a very respectful term, like boss or sir or madam. And you see how, you know, he acts very respectfully toward Koreans. And that's probably because so many migrant workers in Korea are actually often abused. They're often treated as if they're at the bottom of the social hierarchies. And the way that, you know, Ali conducts himself, how the other contestants treat him, it really, you know, reveals a true glimpse of how, you know, social minorities are treated in Korea. So in a way, I was actually impressed to see how Squid Game could kind of be viewed as a social commentary right. on how migrant workers are discriminated, even though they take up of so much of Korea's labor. I mean, Ali is shown to be this really, really strong character. And yeah, that's kind of like a symbol of how much migrant workers make up for the labor.
And what are some of the other themes that the show reflects in terms of Korea today, politically and societally?
Yeah, definitely. The first thing that comes to mind is the huge socioeconomic inequalities and the gap between the rich and poor. I think especially a lot of the younger generation, when they were watching this show, could resonate with the themes because, you know, nowadays, just the gap is becoming bigger and bigger and the pandemic is just worsening it. And so a lot of young people are starting to feel that, you know, the very conventional idea of labor, like going to work 9 to 5, you know, the office work, and then you get your salary, you save up, and you buy an apartment and a home. That kind of dream is becoming more and more, you know, outside of their boundaries. It's becoming more and more difficult to achieve that. Whereas for the elder generation, they were mostly, you know, compensated and always rewarded for their hard work. Now the younger generation feels that no matter how much, you know, how hard they work, how, you know, how they study hard to get good grades and go to like the best universities, they may never achieve that dream of, you know, getting married, you know, owning a house, having children. And so a lot of young people today feel very discouraged and they start to like discriminate themselves in terms of class. Like you're born with, you know, a gold spoon in your mouth and I'm not, I'm born with like the dirt spoon. So they call themselves the spoon generation. Mm-hmm. And yeah, it's really sad. And they believe that your background and your family inheritance are much more important than your own hard work in achieving success. And because of that, I think a lot of people start to believe that the idea of labor is becoming more and more devalued. And they're starting to look towards stock markets and cryptocurrency like Bitcoins and NFTs, more, you know, alternative ways to bring in cash to the flow. So I think those are one of the things that the show really resonates with younger viewers.
And I wanted to ask you about the female characters, Saibyuk and Player 212. I think her name is Han Minyo. Am I saying that right? Mm-hmm. Han Minyo?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. How would you say that women are depicted in this series?
To be honest, as a, you know, female myself, I think the character depictions for female characters are quite flat. I don't think they're really in depth as, you know, Sang-woo or Ki-hoon or even the old man's character. Or even, you know, I forgot his name, but the younger brother of the front man, the cop who's, you know, trying right, to reveal thing. Everything. Yeah, they all have this very rich story behind them. And, you know, they have a chance to tell them. And we do get to hear Sebyeok's and also Jiyoung's story in episode 6. And, you know, how Sebyeok, you know, escaped is a North Korean refugee. Right. Right, and she went through all this trouble and she only now has her brother and blah blah blah, and like Jiyoung also had family troubles, domestic violence, but we don't really hear anything else from Minya or other female characters. And also I've noticed a lot, some of the games are actually based more on strength, and there weren't any games that girls used to enjoy when they were children. So like I've had all these games that I used to play when I was like a little child, and I didn't see any of those games depicted in the show. So that was kind of disappointing in a sense. Especially, I think Minya's character can be viewed as problematic in a sense, because she voluntarily sells sex to get on the stronger team. And I think I read an interview where the director said that it's more to show how people can do desperate things when, you know, they become in a desperate state and, you know, they have to live. Sometimes you'll do something that you don't want to do. But I think as, you know, a Korean female, that's also kind of a dangerous way to depict women, especially when there is a rise of anti-feminism in South Korea. I think the idea that women will voluntarily, you know, sell sex to get ahead or to get something for their means might actually feed into what a lot of incels believe in. So I'm actually not happy with the way that the female characters are portrayed. And maybe there's a chance that, you know, the show can redeem that in season 2. So, yeah.
And just briefly about the Il-nam character, the older, the general, mm-hmm. I will spoil and say that he's the one that it turns out has been behind this whole thing.
Right.
What does he represent? And the VIPs and the whole structure of this thing.
Yeah, I think all of those people, I mean, they're these very, very privileged men. And, you know, again, interesting, you don't see any, you know, female VIP or, you know, female CEO among them. So I think it also kind of maybe unconsciously reveals how South Korea is this very patriarchal society where a lot of the privileged men, they haven't really cared, or maybe they still don't care about the structural inequalities of society where the younger generation is still struggling to find a permanent job, a stable job, to earn a salary, to make ends meet, while they're just, you know, throwing money around and seeing people, you know, harm themselves just for the pleasure. So I think that also says something about how maybe those, you know, who are privileged and fortunate should try to think about how to maybe correct these kind of systematic inequalities.
If you're an athlete, you know the greatest motivator of all is the fear of letting your teammates down. After all, a team is only as good as its weakest link. So you owe it to those wearing the same jersey as you to be your best every time you step on the field. That's why there's no vape in team. When you vape, you can expose your lungs to toxic chemicals that can damage your lungs. If you're a step behind, the team's a step behind. Brought to you by The Real Cost and the FDA.
Before we get into more of the aesthetics of it, that this is, I was reading your very interesting commentary in the Washington Post about how this is resonating with South Korean politicians.
Yeah, so like I said before, a lot of younger people believe that your family inheritance or your background is way more important than your own hard work in achieving success. And that's because there has been a number of cases in which like sons or daughters of very high profile people were able to get, you know, jobs easier or, you know, grants or any kind of position easier. And once that is revealed, of course, you know, the younger generation feels very betrayed and they're very upset about that. And I think politicians, especially those who are running for president in the next election, are claiming that they will get rid of this kind of corruption. They will make sure they will create a fair society. But I don't know. I mean, actually, I think Squid Game shows you how there can't be a fair society. I mean, the Squid Game guards claim, it's actually very the opposite. They claim that everything will be fair. We will conduct the game so that nobody has an advantage. But you see all these loopholes. You see Minyo using a lighter during the candy game. And you see none of the guards, you know, pointing her out or anything. So she had already had an advantage. So you see all these people with loopholes in the system. And I think the Squid Game actually shows how you can't create a fair society. There's already too many, you know, inequalities just rooted in the system.
Which I've seen as intentional on the part of writer-director mm-hmm. Dong-hook, that's what he wanted to. Would you agree?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
So talking about, I just mentioned the director, Hwang Dong-hyuk, he's had a few big movies before. We've been reading in the past that this took many, many years and he had to sell his computer. I think he said that there were 10 different production companies that didn't want to do this. What is his place in Korean cinema and television?
I have not seen all of his films, but there was one film I was really impressed with. It's called Silenced, or maybe there's a different title called like The Crucible. I think on Wikipedia it says both Silenced and The Crucible. It's a film about these young minors, young children who were sexually assaulted in institutions, and how, you know, this teacher reveals everything and fights for the young children. And that was based on a true incident. And after that film, so many viewers who were, you know, affected by that film started, you know, arguing for and started petitioning for law reformation. And so that I think after that, South Korean Assembly passed this bill so that, you know, the statute of limitation for sexual assault for minors would be, it was gone. So I think for a film to have that kind of, you know, effect on society it's huge. And
so he's always been interested in class injustice and societal issues.
Yeah, I haven't seen his other two films.
No, at least in that one. Yeah.
Yeah. In a sense, I have a sense that he's interested in representing these kind of social political issues through his work. And I think that's incredible, because we talk about, you know, which candidate, which president will be able to make a better society. But in addition to that, maybe it's not just one president. Maybe it's not just a few politicians who can do the job. Maybe, you know, art can also really make a change for the better.
Earlier mentioning the aesthetics of this series, this sort of this mix between dystopia and these very bright colors. And what is he drawing upon in modern Korean popular culture? Or is he?
Well, that's a very interesting question. Well, I think, you know, the bright pink colors, they actually create this very tense, you know, kind of suffocating atmosphere And then all the other set designs, like, you know, the playground or the place where the scary doll was, or, you know, the setting where they were playing marbles, you know, in that kind of really cute neighborhood area. I think that's all very reminiscent of the olden days of South Korea, like in the 80s or the early 90s. And I think a lot of that actually creates nostalgia for the viewers. So in a sense, I think that tension,
So the doll that you mentioned, isn't that a doll from like South Korean school books that you've grown up with, that doll? So that makes it sort of extra scary that that's this incredibly violent feature.
Exactly. Yeah. When you enrolled in Korean elementary school and you receive your first textbook and you open it, there's a sentence that says like, I'm a boy, you're a girl. Like, and the boy's name is Cheol-su and the girl's name is Young-hee. So the doll actually represents Young-hee. And so I don't have any, you know, small children, but I'm actually curious to see how, you know, the small children react to, well, they're not actually supposed to watch.
They shouldn't be seeing this.
Yeah, it's, I think it's like rated like for 18 and older, so they should not see this. But, you know, I mean, if they ever did get to see it accidentally, I mean, it would be so confusing for them because it's that, you know, friendly girl from the textbook and she's now, you know, a complete monster.
What about that? That's exactly sort of it. These childhood games contrasted with the absolutely, I mean, the violence in this show is brutal. Mm-hmm. I mean, or is it sort of a video game culture? Or I don't know what I'm getting at.
I don't know. I mean, like, I watch a lot of American TV most of the time. So for me, it didn't seem like that violent. It was just like, oh, okay, just, you know, what you see on American TV.
I think it's this mix of the, as you were saying, these childhood games. And then suddenly, mm-hmm. I think that's more striking than when the blood squirts on the pink walls type of thing.
Yeah. So, you know, that kind of very familiar, ordinary setting with all that your childhood games. And then that, you know, huge contrast, all these violent, bloody, you know, things going on. I think that's also maybe, you know, a common theme we see in other Korean films and TV, like the film Parasite. It's just happening in an ordinary neighborhood. Or maybe like there's another Netflix original called Sweet Home. It's also a Korean production and it's about, it's a dystopian setting. It's kind of a zombie flick, but it also shows like, you know, how do we preserve humanity? How do we perform humanity in these kind of dystopian setting. So I think it's kind of like a common, you know, setting nowadays, staging a very ordinary, you know, neighborhood setting, and then, you know, something poof happens.
Yeah, I mean, that's sort of what dystopia is. The violence or the scary thing is right here with us. It's not far away anymore. Mm-hmm. The stars in this, I mean, the actors, this must be, we were huge before. I know a few of them have had big careers before, and I know there's a bunch of cameos and guest stars who were are really big stars there. But how is the fandom around the show?
Yeah, I thought that was really interesting because Ki-hoon was played by Lee Jung-jae. He's actually a really popular star in Korea. I mean, I've seen his debut when I was in like third grade, which was his like first TV drama, and it was a big hit. So he's a very, in my opinion, he's a very lucky person. His debut show was a huge hit, and he had a really steady career of good films and, you know, TV dramas. And now he's like over 50 years old and he's suddenly this big international superstar. So
and he's played mostly villains, right?
Yes, he's played mostly villains in like in this Korean film called, I don't know the English title, like Gwansang, and also something else called Deliver Us From Evil. So he's mostly played villains, but I remember his debut TV drama, which was called Hourglass, and he was this very loyal, trustworthy bodyguard. He had like two lines in the entire show. He was mostly somebody who would just like protect the leading lady. So I still kind of remember him as this, you know, very nice character from the show I saw in third grade. And like you said, there's a lot of very interesting cameos. The front man played by Lee Byung-hun, he's also really incredibly big star in Korea, one of the best actors. And the person, the salesman who was doing the slapping at the start of the show, Kong Yu, he's one of the biggest heartthrob actors. He was in The Goblin and a lot of other things.
Yeah, I saw that. And he did, and they're right. There's many people on Twitter like, oof, they have him in a suit. He looks amazing. And I, yeah.
Yeah. And he was actually also the star for the filmmakers earlier one, called The Silence, the one I was talking about with the young.
He was
a star for that film too. So I think, yeah, that's maybe how he got to be a cameo in this one. And I think for Sebyeok, Jung Ho-yeon, she's kind of a new rookie, but it's been amazing to see how she has turned from this, you know, rookie model into this international superstar. I really do hope she has a lot of good things, a lot of good roles, new TV shows coming her way. And the guy who plays the younger brother, the cop Lee Ha-jun, he's been around. I saw him in a few TV dramas and also in this film called Gonjiam, The Haunted Asylum. It's a horror flick, which was also directed by one of my friends. And he did a really good job in that film too. So I had my eye on him for a while. And yeah, he's now a big superstar.
Amazing. So. That's great. Yeah. Finally, I know Netflix is just pumped in millions and millions for Korean content before this, mm-hmm. but what does this show and the success that came out of this mean for Korean film and TV?
Yeah, I did read somewhere that Netflix invested a lot in Korean originals. I also read somewhere that the entire budget for Squid Game was like 1/10 of the budget of The Crown. So maybe in Netflix's opinion, investing in Korean contents is a win-win for them. You know, Korean contents get more exposure. Netflix gets to create this, you know, amazing show with like 1/10 of the budget. So maybe it's a win-win.
I can't believe that because both sides. It looks so expensive. You know, the set design, the music is incredible. The music is the same guy who did Parasite, I think.
Yes, Jung Jae. Yes, he's a really popular composer. Yeah.
Incredibly good. And I mean, just all the incredible stars you were mentioning. That seems like a cheap price.
Yeah.
They could just go film some castles for The Crown. They really need that.
I know, right? Yeah. Yeah, I think it's great. I also think the recent popularity of, you know, Korean pop culture maybe helped with Squid Game's global success. But in a way, a lot of people wonder if the Squid Game was specifically catered towards Western audiences, but I don't think the director specifically had in mind, like, okay, I'm gonna make a show, you know, just so Americans or, you know, Europeans would, you know, something they would love. I think he created a very Korean-specific content. And the universal themes in that show resonated with viewers all around the world, I think. And I think that's great, you know, in a sense. This is a time in the pandemic where there's so much, you know, anti-Asian hate, you know, all kinds of hate everywhere. So I think through this kind of content, through this kind of, you know, art, we can have discussions about, you know, things that we have in common, things that we resonate with, and, you know, maybe that can help create, you know, a very peaceful conversation in a sense.
Yes, I think so too. Dr. Jung, thank you so much for your time. This was so interesting. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
Science, science, science! Science, science! Hello, podcast fans. Want to get weird with us? Come check out the Mad Scientist Podcast. We are a weekly show that looks at the history, philosophy, and hard facts behind your biggest paranormal questions.
Did the government really pay for a psychic spy program?
Yes!
Is it true that surgery got its start in grave robbing?
Yes!
Can a roller coaster really kill you?
Legally, we can't say so for sure, but sometimes, yes! Join myself, Chris Cogswell, and my co-host, Marie Mayhew, as we examine the science, philosophy, and history behind the strange and unusual. All to discover what's possible and plausible versus what's, well, just made up. Check us out wherever you find your favorite podcasts. The Mad Scientist Podcast.